The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. We have a show chock full of interesting stuff today. We'll start with Doug Rushkoff about his book, Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. We'll spend an hour talking with all about Mayor Sheila Dixon's trial, Dwight Pettit among our guests today. And then we will meet some really three interesting people, new Open Society Institute fellows who are here to seek to do their work to change the lives of many people. So we'll get into all that and more in just a minute. But first, let's turn this over to WEAA Traffic and get you all home nice, safe, and sound. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are going to have a conversation for the first part of our program with Douglas Rushkoff. He wrote the book Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. He's an award-winning documentary filmmaker. The Merchants of Cool and The Persuaders were incredible films and award-winning films on Frontline. He hosts Media Squad at WFMU, and I could go on and on, but won't, because we're going to talk to him instead. He was on the Colbert Report, and now he's on the Mark Steiner Show. And Douglas Rushkoff, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, great to be with you.
Pleasure. Thank you for writing this book. This is an amazing piece of work you put together.
Oh, thanks. It was actually bizarrely fun to do, because although it kind of started out as an investigation into how we ended up living like this and how we internalized corporate values and why we use the kind of money we use, it ended up being kind of inspiring to see people ready for something else, you know, how people took it, really, rather than as a pessimistic message, as a really optimistic message of our ability to kind of work our way out of the financial mire in which we found ourselves.
The book comes at a very interesting time. I mean, I want to kind of quickly walk through some of the historical issues in the book and get to the meat of the moment with you while we have you with us. Number here is 410-319-8888. Douglas Rushkoff with us, author of the book Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. There's a lot of things that are interesting you turn your head. Let me just start with one. When you write about Adam Smith, who all the conservatives and people look at as the father of modern capitalism, and you see his legacy as something very different.
Yeah, I was actually surprised, you know, because I came to this as a regular person, you know, not as an economist, just as a regular person and a media theorist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all that a media theorist means is someone who doesn't take anything for granted.
Right, exactly.
You don't believe it, right. So you got to go look. And I always heard, you know, sort of Adam Smith in the same sentence as like Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman, you know, and I think, oh, this is just one of those, you know. And, you know, you go back and you read the fellow and you find out that he was just as mad at corporations as he was at big government. You know, he saw big corporations and big government really as the same thing. And what he was looking for, what he thought of as free market capitalism, as a free market economy, was all sorts of small business people, sort of local businesses, being able to compete on a level playing field with the biggest ones, you know, which is largely what the American Revolution was about. It was not really against the king so much as the king's corporations, which had the exclusive right to do pretty much all business in the American colonies. You know, you couldn't, if you grew cotton on a farm, you couldn't sell it to other people. You couldn't make clothes out of it and then sell them either. You had to sell it to the company, British East India Trading Company. It was shipped all the way back to England, fabricated into clothes, then shipped all the way back to America, where you had to buy it at fixed prices. Everybody was going nuts. You know, no one was allowed to actually create or exchange value anymore.
So, from your perspective, I mean, there's been when I read your book, it was not like reading Marx, because it was different, because the way you talk about the beginnings of corporations, where they came from, the tie into medieval society and how they began and how they're very much how what we have today is not too dissimilar from where you see it beginning. Talk about how you see this beginning and what the purpose of a corporation really is.
Yeah, you know, I mean, again, it's like goes back to being a media theorist. I look at this thing, there's this couple of media out there, you know, whether it's cash, which is a medium, or the corporation, which is almost like a broadcast center. And, you know, well, where did these things come from? What are they? What is really, what is a corporation? And, you know, I went all the way back and, you know, to the late Middle Ages when they were invented. I was like, well, why were they invented? Who invented them?
Right.
And it turns out that in the late Middle Ages, there was a real economic boom. I mean, we always think of it as the Dark Ages, and then we think of this, you know, horrible, dark 1,000-year period, but there were actually a couple of pretty good centuries in there, at least in terms of economic growth. People were trading, there were merchants who were traveling all over the place, and the problem with this great, big, rising middle class of merchants and, you know, tailors and tinsmiths and, you know, blacksmiths and everyone else and cobblers is the ultra-rich, the people who had just always been rich simply by being rich and creating no value, those people were starting to get poor in comparison. The middle class was getting richer than the aristocracy. So in a kind of last gasp Hail Mary pass, they created these things called corporate charters. And this is where the king or the aristocrat would go running to, you know, the biggest businessman that he could find and say, look, why don't we be friends? I will give you an exclusive monopoly over your industry, so you will never have to worry about competition again, and I will put it in law, and all you have to do is let me invest in the company or give me 10%. And to merchants who had fought long and hard to get onto the top, they welcomed the opportunity to have that guaranteed because now they didn't have to innovate anymore. Now they didn't have to compete. Now they could just worry about extracting the most value from the charter, from the monopoly that they had been granted. And now kings and other aristocracy could make money passively simply by having money rather than actually doing anything. And when you start realizing that, well, if the corporation was created to do that, then it's actually got nothing to do with all this free market capitalism and competition that we're talking about. It was actually created to do the opposite, to prevent competition, to lock in place a certain power structure and to prevent other things from happening.
I wonder, one of the things that I thought about reading the book, though, is that if that is part of the dynamic we face in this world, can the free market ever really flourish as a free market? Because the very nature of it and its relationship to the very powerful and wealthy, the corporations from the 1400s to this 21st century, are just going to eat them up, and that's the nature of the beast.
I mean, it is in some ways, you know, it is the nature of the beast. It's like you look at the majority of the medieval times, and it was feudalism, which was a few really rich and powerful guys controlled all the other people. That kind of loosened by the late Middle Ages, and then boom, in they come with early corporatism and the colonial empires going out. You know, and then that starts to loosen, and boom, we get the Industrial Age and the assembly line and the suburbs and all of these other means of social control. And now it's starting to get loose again because of the internet and people being able to just make stuff anywhere and sell it on eBay or Etsy or whatever they want. And now what are we getting? Another big shakedown.
Right.
We're getting an economic crisis like we haven't certainly seen in our lifetimes. And everybody's scrambling. But I see this also each time there's one of these crashes, each time there's one of these great wobbles, I feel like there's also the opportunity for people to reconnect, at least to some extent, with the value they create and to consider alternatives. You know, I think that on the grand scale, on the global scale, it's almost impossible to compete with the global players, with the big boys. But on a local scale, I think it is possible to compete effectively. You know, if we can just get local laws for local commerce and land use and the simplest things tilted back, if not in our favor, as Adam Smith would want it, at least on a level playing field, then I think people will start to find more satisfaction and more prosperity, you know, learning to do certain things locally and scaled to the kind of more to the human body and human communities and other things, like, you know, maybe buying your iPhone is something that you're going to do on a more global scale.
So one of the things that, we always wrestle with here about the corporate power and political power and how they're intertwined, and how, as you write in your book, Big Pharma, Big Agra, they're all part of this, the big government we have, and they all are tied in to controlling what they have. But you don't see it as a conspiracy. You see it as more of as is. The people aren't necessarily evil, but perhaps it's that the capitalist system as a whole is the evil system that, you have to deal with, and it's just in nature organically what grows out of it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you look at some of the worst things that happened to the United States were perpetrated even by a guy like FDR, who actually did, I believe, mean well for America. You know, he knew that all these veterans were going to be coming back from the war. They were going to be angry. They were going to be all screwed up. I mean, all his psychologists told him that these were, you know, some of the most traumatized veterans ever to return to America. You know, they had an economy they were going to have to rebuild somehow. And he thought, okay, let me meet with the Levitt brothers, which he did, and let's come up with a new idea for a suburbia that will help calm these people, that will prevent men from congregating together and forming mobs and getting, you know, getting into trouble, and will keep them very busy, you know, needing to buy stuff to fill their homes and to pay their mortgages. He didn't think that he was creating this awful kind of, you know, suburban malaise and the rat race that he ended up creating. He didn't see it as a means of social control. He saw it as a means of just you know, pacifying and pleasing a potentially irate group of people. You know, what did he end up doing? Of course, was just assisting a system. So rather than, for me, rather than looking at these things in terms of sort of good and evil, are there good people or bad people, I kind of look at the systems instead in terms of whether they, you know, whether they promote our humanity or whether they are dedicated more just towards extracting value from humanity. You know, and sort of when you look at it that way, you say, oh, I get it. You know, that's the difference between, say, open source and crowdsourcing. That's the difference between people working for a living and people working in order to get out of whatever business they're in.
So, I mean, when people like Annie Leonard do her story of stuff, you know about that?
Uh-huh.
So she, and I was thinking about it because I interviewed her just recently, and I'm looking, read your book. And so, you know, that while it's not a conspiracy, I mean, it was a very conscious effort to turn America into a consumer economy, a corporate consumer economy that we're all part of. We all buy into it. We're all a piece of it.
Well, we are. I mean, we're all, you know, complicit in a sense, and that even many of us who are against all of this consumerism try not to buy ourselves. You know, we still have 401k retirement plans in various consumer industries, and we get upset when those stock numbers go down, and they're only going down because there's other people who can't afford to consume all the stuff that we would need them to consume. I mean, it is ultimately an unsustainable system. And I know, you know, you guys have talked a lot about, you know, currency and how currency came about and how banking works, you know, and it just, it doesn't work. It's not a great long-term strategy. You know, central banking was really invented, just like corporations. It was invented so that people who had money could make money simply by having money rather than doing anything. And the only way to do that is to make all local money systems, all local trade illegal, and to force people instead to use this money which only you can issue. And what does that do? That leads to an interest-based economy, and an interest-based economy needs to grow at the rate of interest rather than the rate of supply and demand. So people need to be provoked to buy more and more stuff in order to keep these engines going, in order to keep the economy expanding. So then if you're a, you know, a well-meaning guy like Obama, who already accepts this as a given circumstance rather than as a system put in place by real people, if you go into it thinking this is just the way it works, then you'll end up making the kinds of speeches he does, which is, oh, bank lending is the basic fuel of the economy. The way to get these towns going is to get corporations to move in there and hire people. It's because to the underlying assumption of the economics that he's using, the economics that most people believe in, is a presumption that was put in place really just by a few people back in the 1300s who were trying to make money by having money and were trying to quash an economy based on abundance. And I feel like people are smart enough, and people now have enough tools, you know, just with the computers in their hands at this point, that we really have all the tools that a treasury had 20 years ago. And we can really start to do peer-to-peer transactions. We can start to develop local or scaled businesses. We can start demonstrating that human activity leads to wealth. You know, that's what leads to prosperity. I was talking with the editor of Rolling Stone the other day, and he was confused on this whole issue of money, and I told him, look, just get it like this. Music doesn't make money, or rather, money doesn't make music. Music makes money. And he was like, oh, I get it. In other words, it's sort of, I mean, you could kind of, I guess you could call that Marx, finally. You know, that,
or somebody. Or Bakunin. Doug Rushkoff wrote the book Life Incorporated, How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join this conversation. One of the things, when you think about where you're going with this, is that you would have advised President Obama not to bail out the banks, right?
I was one of the early too big to fail means too big to live.
Uh-huh.
People. You know, it's one thing to allow these institutions to be out there and to suck out our economic resources by any means necessary. I mean, I can understand when the economy is going well that wealth is going to move from poor people to rich people or from the periphery to these centralized institutions. But then when things are going bad, we do the same thing. So now we're taking my grandchildren, my non-existent as of yet grandchildren's money, and paying the banks the money that they lost betting against the stuff that they were selling us. Or, you know, it's just too many levels on which I feel like I'm paying these folks, and on which, you know, an economy really can't exist to serve an economy. You know, the economy has to exist to serve people. It's this classist idea, the sort of Wall Street versus Main Street dichotomy, isn't really the one we're talking about.
What
it's
is
really
it, then?
Humans versus institutions. It's the actual need of human beings for cash through which to carry out transactions, and the hoarding of cash by institutions, and of course some wealthy people who work there. But it's this hoarding of money. It's this. The money itself has two functions in the way we use it now. It's both to help people transact and to help people save. And when you end up in an economy that's so biased towards interest and interest-bearing currency, then you end up with this kind of with a speculative economy that's sucking all of the money out of the system. And it's not that we don't have enough money to have savings or to be wealthy. It's that we don't have enough money in the real economy to actually conduct transactions.
Because all these corporations are really just big debt machines.
They are big debt machines, right, and leveraged money and all that fake money out there. So you end up, I mean, I get these letters from like people in Lansing, Michigan, saying, when are we going to get GM to come back here, you know, to rebuild our economy for us? And I keep trying to explain to them, if you've got people with needs and you've got other people with skills, you have the basis of an economy. They have both of those things. What they don't have is greenbacks. That no one has cash, so the people who have needs can pay the people who can render services. So if you can't get cash that way, then I advise them to make their own currencies. We're seeing that happen in a lot of towns.
What does that mean, make your own currency? I mean, the last president we had that made his own currency was Abraham Lincoln. So what do you mean by that?
There's all sorts of currencies. There's time dollars and all sorts of new currency systems that are arising in communities that just can't get regular cash, and these things really do work. You know, in Japan during the recession, hundreds of millions of dollars of health care were provided by people using an alternative currency system. That all you would do is, you know, you would work and take care of someone's elder relative in one part of the country. You'd accrue a number of credits that were on a computer database on the internet. And once you had enough credits, then you could pay someone else with those credits to take care of your old relative in some other part of the country. And it was such a successful healthcare system that even though, for the most part, they're out of the recession right now, people are still preferring to use that form of healthcare rather than the so-called professional healthcare.
So if we kind of talk about where we go from here, because sometimes you talk, I get a sense from your book that you were also talking about railing against the system doesn't necessarily work. Railing against corporations doesn't necessarily work. But so A, what takes its place? And B, then is there, what's the world, what, from your perspective, going to look like? I mean, on the one hand, you have this system that goes, you know, I may go out to the farmer down the road from me and I don't care what the government says. If I like the milk that comes from his cow, I'm going to buy it. Right?
So
that's me and this farmer. But,
right. Well, it takes a lot of trust. It takes a lot of trust in yourself and other people to even get to that place.
It does.
Right? Where I'm going to trust this farmer and what I see and how he raises his cows and what kind of grass he's using. I'm going to trust that over what the FDA stamps on the thing. You know, that's something in itself.
So where's the balance between building a society between us and the needs of having things like a healthcare system, highways, schools?
Where's the balance? Exactly, I don't know. But I can tell you the balance is a lot closer to the human scale than it is currently.
That
right now, the ability of people to do that kind of thing for each other and with each other is really muted. It's quite repressed. You know, we're at a place now where when, you know, the major toy conglomerates screw up their outsourcing to China and end up with lead paint on their little trains, that we end up putting in place a series of laws that put all small domestic toy manufacturers out of business. You know, with the way consumer protection and government and corporate toy making got together was to create new testing regulations that cost, you know, $40,000 or $50,000 per toy. So what garage business of little toy manufacturers is going to be able to compete with that? They're not. You know, the law exists to preserve the monopoly of these conglomerates while they're poisoning the toys that they're putting out. So it's like good news is good news for them and bad news is good news for them.
So if corporations, if the people running them are not evil in their own right, as many people would think they are, because railing against Wall Street is a full-time occupation for most Americans at this moment because people are so angry at what's going on. Tell us about what from your perspective, the purpose of a corporation as you write about it and what people should do about it.
Well, I mean, the purpose of a corporation, and again, it's once you get out of good and evil and just look at it as a function, you don't get as hot about it. But the purpose of a corporation is quite simply to extract as much value from people and places as possible. That's what it's for. So there are times when that's a really interesting tool to use. We've got to extract value out of these people or out of this place. We've got to, and if you use your corporation as an authority, like the Metropolitan Transit Authority, you can build a bridge or take care of some public need. You know, and I'm not saying that that's a bad pursuit. Those are worthwhile pursuits. You know, but There are definitely ways for people to work and create and exchange value together that don't necessarily involve these sort of giant anti-competitive institutions. You know, and worst of all, or best of all, I guess, depending on your perspective, you know, we have a choice as to whether we're going to instill ourselves and internalize the value systems of the corporations we work for. I mean, it's one thing to outsource your work to corporations and outsource your purchasing to corporations and you outsource your savings and your investment. But there's also a point when you can decide to take some of these things back. What if I want to work for myself? What if I want to invest in a local restaurant? What if I want to spend my time less efficiently rather than more efficiently? What if I want to spend more time with my kids? What if I want to contribute my time to the public school rather than my money to the private school? And what would that look like? And how do I get others to join me in that pursuit? You know, when we live by corporate values, we tend to use almost a kind of an insulation equation about our lives, where we look at all problems as things to throw money at, and every problem is something, well, I'm going to have to work harder or longer to get the money to spend to insulate myself from whatever this problem is in the real world. And it doesn't occur to us that we could actually just go as humans and work on that problem directly. And that's sort of what I'm arguing for.
Well, when you argue in your book, and we only have a few minutes left, so I want to get you back here to have a much longer discussion or argument. I'm sorry, it's only a half an hour today. But when you argue in your book that we see John Roberts, the former Delta Force, building these companies, and you have Halliburton, Parsons, Bechtel taking over private industry, taking over the military work, and big pharma, big agriculture, and Wall Street and their power. In controlling that, you talk about International Monetary Fund and how they control whole countries and keep them in debt so they can't even take care of themselves. How do you go up? So how do you change that?
Well, I mean, luckily or unluckily, depending on who you are, that's changing. I mean, Obama realized that when he came into office and basically said the jig is up. You know, these countries understand what IMF and World Bank debt means, that the rest of the world is no longer open to our expansion. I mean, this is what got, you know, the right wing or the corporate libertarians, you know, all upset, was he was basically saying we are going to have to learn as a nation how to create value. We're going to have to learn how to do something rather than just how to extract value from other people.
And so you see in the ultimately what you've been writing here, your analysis of this from your media perspective, you're optimistic about where we're going.
Honestly, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about where we're going. You know, if people can kind of stop just joining movements and other sort of branded angry, if people stop just blogging about everything. And, you know, start participating in the flesh, I think we'll stand a lot better chance of, creating a world and a community fabric that can serve our interests.
Well, you know, I really, this book is just illuminating, and I really love the time you've taken with this. And I would love to have you come back and join us for some more conversation very soon.
Oh, sure, whenever you like. It doesn't have to be about my book either. It can be about whatever you're really talking about, too.
If you have time to join us for panels that we have all the time about all the issues that we face and life in general, we'd love to have you back.
Terrific.
Be great. Thanks for everything you do.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. We've been talking with Douglas Rushkoff. His book is Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. You can go to his website and see more about what he's saying. That's rushkoff.com, rushkoff.com. Link to it from our website at steinershow.org. It's really food for thought. I want to invite all of you, by the way, to join me this Saturday night, November 21st at the Creative Alliance at the Patterson. We are doing Voices of a People's History, Howard Zinn's great work. There'll be two shows, 6 and 9 p.m. I'm playing Eugene V. Debs. Many great people there who are going to be in this class, including Sheila Gaskins and Kay Lawal Muhammad and Liz Lerman, Bashi Rose, Joyce Scott, many, many more. And you can call 410-276-1651 for more information. Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by the National Connections Academy, an accredited online private school with affordable tuition for grades K through 12. Visit nationalconnectionsacademy.com for more information. When we come back, we get joined by Dwight Pettit, Fern Chen, Doug Holbert, and Melody Simmons to cover and look what happened today at Sheila Dixon's trial. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We are going to take a look, of course, at what happened today in Mayor Sheila Dixon's trial. It is really very interesting. The judge threw out 2 of 7 counts. So much is going on there. We have to, it's just changing by the moment. And we're watching legal chess games going on, which we're going to try to parse through this hour. We are joined in studio by the great Dwight Pettit, criminal defense attorney here in Baltimore. Dwight, great to see you.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be with you.
Thank you for coming all the way in here to do this in the studio.
My privilege.
We are joined on the phone by Melody Simmons, who's a reporter for WEAA and for the Center for Emerging Media. She's working for us down there now covering this trial every day. And Melody, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Hey, Mark. Good to be back.
And we're also joined this hour by Fern Shen, who spent years working at the Post and the Sun, and is now founder, editor, and publisher of the Baltimore Brew, which you can find at www.baltimorebrew.com and follow their coverage of the trial. And Melody writes there as well. Fern, welcome. Welcome to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be here. I'm speaking to you from the offices of Baltimore Brew, otherwise known as my kitchen table.
Good small business. I like that.
World headquarters.
The world headquarters.
There we are, yeah. The media mogul speaks here. So. Hello there, everybody.
And Doug Colbert will be joining us around the half an hour from now. He's got to take care of some family stuff, and he's going to join us by phone for his analysis as well, who's professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law. Before we start, jump right into this and get listeners to join us at 410-319-8888. Fern, I got to tell you, I love what you're doing in Baltimore, but you have this contest going on. If you write the best poem about the Dixon trial, you get a slew of gift cards. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. Hey, we might want to stay away from SLU. That sort of got our mayor in trouble. But,
okay.
We're going to give out a couple of gift cards. And, I was all set to buy some more next week if the trial went on, but looks like these two that I bought are going to be it. So our thought with this thing was, gift cards, we've been hearing about how they bought, the camcorders and, hobo bags. And we thought we'd kick it up a notch and have them buy something kind of classier, namely some poetry.
So there you go. I like that. We'll talk more about that in the course of the hour. So let's get your perspective first, Dwight. Well, let me do this. Let's get the news first. Melody, tell us what you saw at the trial today, and then we're going to have Dwight Pettit jump in to talk a bit about what all this means.
Well, the trial started off this morning, and it continued pretty much in the fashion that it's been going. There was a representative from Circuit City called to the stand first thing, 10 a.m., and there was just some very bread-and-butter testimony, a little boring, talking about Circuit City gift cards. And about 5 minutes to 11, after that witness had been dismissed, the state prosecutor, Robert Warbaugh, stood up and said, "Your Honor, the state rests." And everybody in the courtroom was stunned because, of course, there was talk about their star witness, Mr. Lipscomb, Ronald Lipscomb coming in to testify against the mayor, he, of course, being her former boyfriend, and also a very influential and wealthy developer in town. So from that moment, things started moving in quick motion. The jurors were dismissed for a lunch break. The attorney stayed in the courtroom. Then the first started to fly pretty fast and furious. The defense moved for a mistrial, and then but first they moved to have some of the charges against the mayor thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
The judge actually threw out 2 of the 7 charges against Mayor Dixon right there on the spot after some arguing.
And what were those charges they threw out?
Mostly related to Mr. Lipscomb's testimony and the gift cards that he allegedly had purchased for charity, some of which were spent by the mayor and then city council president. So because he never took the witness stand, the charges that were related to what would have been his testimony were dismissed.
So, Dwight Pettit, what is going on here from your perspective? I mean,
it's very shocking, Mark. Not only I'm sure everybody in the courtroom, but everybody in the city is probably shocked. It's going to be interesting as to why he made that move. That was his star witness, as we know. There's some speculation that it was a strategic move and that he could have been planning to bring Lipscomb back in some type of rebuttal fashion. I don't find that a valid reason. The only thing that I can think of at this point in time is that something transpired over the last day or last 2 days that made Lipscomb's credibility of such a delicacy that they did not want to risk his cross-examination on his testimony in terms of destroying the whole case and tried to salvage part of the case. What that could have been, I think, will come out at a later time. What's before you now, of course, the motion to dismiss a judgment of acquittal has been granted as to the two charges, as just Melanie just stated. But more important is the motion for a new trial, because even though the court, I think, might have reserved, Melanie can tell me, did the judge rule on the motion for a new trial at all?
Yes, he did rule and said he didn't think that that was the case, you know, basically because he felt there was merit in the five remaining charges to put it before the jury. And
I'm not talking about the motion for judgment of acquittal now. I'm talking, see, the new trial, motion for a new trial. Did he rule on that, if you recall?
He ruled against it.
Okay. Now, I think that that is highly, highly suspect, because not only opening argument, but you've got so much testimony that's been allowed to come in, which was going to serve as a foundation for all of the charges based on Lipscomb's testimony. You
right.
Take out his testimony. How do you substantiate or sustain that evidence remaining in? Because what that evidence does that now never comes in, although the jury's heard it, you can instruct the jury, but the jury has heard all of this. So the jury has been highly prejudiced by evidence that's now not going to be tied together.
Prejudice against the prosecution's case.
Prejudice against the defendant.
Against the defendant.
Yes.
And that was one of the charges that one of Mayor Dixon's attorneys, Dale Kelberman, said earlier today, that the jury had marinated in a lot of the facts about Doricon, about Mr. Lipscomb, about those gift cards, and it would be almost impossible to give them a charge to go in and deliberate, knowing all that, now that those charges had been thrown out. The judge did not agree to that, and he said that we will work very specifically. In fact, they released the jurors and closed the courtroom down early today so they could go into chambers and work on the instructions for the jury, which is believed to be around the corner, possibly tomorrow.
Let me say something to you, Melody. The judge, I'm going to say this, the judge might have been so shocked at the developments, he may not have been prepared for the motion for the new trial.
Well, I think the judge is a seasoned veteran, and, you know, he is totally in control of the courtroom.
Yeah, but something like that, I mean, everybody, I don't think anybody, including the judge, didn't expect the state to fold at that point.
You're absolutely
without putting on the star
right.
witness.
Did not. The whole courtroom shook. It was seismic.
And so what I think he might have done, he should have done possibly, is reserved on the ruling. And then, therefore, let the...
What does that mean?
In other words, held it sub curia, not made a ruling. Ruled on the motion for judgment of acquittal, which he did on the two counts. Let the other five counts go forward. Let those go to the jury. And then if the jury came back and he felt was tainted by the evidence that came in as to Lipscomb, or the statements or the information about Lipscomb, because no evidence would have come in. And then he could have ruled and possibly set the jury's verdict aside if the jury had come back with a guilty verdict, or granted the motion for new trial prior to the jury coming back after he's heard the whole case. I think that would probably have been the more appropriate thing to do.
Well, there was a lot of, as I said, fur flying this afternoon, and you know, the big question we had was basically, will the mayor take the stand? And we asked that of the defense attorneys today, and of course they said no comment. So we don't know.
Well, see, there's no way they could be prepared for this either.
Exactly.
Because the biggest determination that they had would be made after the cross-examination of Lipscomb.
They being the defense attorney.
The defense attorney. That was going to be the heart of their case, to destroy his credibility, to destroy him as a witness. Then they could make the decision, because they would have a rational basis of fact to make a determination as to put Mayor Dixon on or not to put him on. You take that away in the middle of the trial, then they have to go back and have a whole reconsideration tonight.
Well, let me ask this question about this seesaw going on. By the way, we just heard Dwight Pettit, criminal defense attorney here based in Baltimore, one of the noted attorneys in our community. Melody Simmons, you've heard, WEAA and Center for Emerging Media reporter covering the trial in the downtown. Fern Shen is covering the trial. She's founder, editor, and publisher of the Baltimore Brew. Number here is 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts on what you've heard about the trial today, where this is going? We have both journalists covering this trial and expert attorneys here to talk about what this day meant. 410-319-8888. Let your voices be heard. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. But this has been It's fascinating. I'm trying to get a layman's sense here of what's going on. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you see the trial open with the shocking defense that Arnold Weiner and company made, saying, yes, these are our, she has these, but they weren't taken from anybody. They were given to her by Lipscomb as a love gift to go buy what you want to buy, basically. And so that took the prosecutor by surprise. Now, the prosecutor's trying to play his chess move, which is saying, okay, we're not putting Lipscomb on because maybe Lipscomb will be destroyed by Weiner, in terms of her credibility, but his case and what he said still stands out there. So now the defense has to come back to figure out, do they put Sheila Dixon on the witness stand? If they do, and I've interviewed Sheila Dixon a dozen times or more, and I've known her for 30 odd years. And under pressure, she's nobody's fool, but under pressure, she doesn't always answer verbally as astute as she would if she wasn't under pressure. So I wonder what we think about what all this means in terms of the trial.
And let me just correct myself. I was saying motion for new trial, but before that, it would be called technically a motion for mistrial.
Okay.
Right.
So where do we think this all stands at the moment?
Well, we don't really know. Tomorrow is going to be the pivotal day. And, there is even some talk about, putting Mayor Dixon on the stand and then having the defense call Lipscomb in and using him as a hostile witness. And so there's all these legal strategies. It's almost like watching a great pitcher's duel going on between the Yankees and the Red Sox, because what you have are these legal minds. Yes, they were caught unaware, came up short, and you saw a lot of shuffling. The defense came in, asked the judge after lunch today, "Judge, we need more time," hoping that he would just call it a day. He gave him 20 minutes. So, there's a lot of shifting going around. They called two character witnesses in for the mayor today, two church friends who got on the stand and told the jury she's honest and hardworking, and that was it. And so this is what we have going on here with the mayor's defense, mostly a character defense at this point.
I was wondering, Dwight, if you could just, I'm like you, Mark, I sort of feel like the layperson trying to make sense of it all. How would you grade the prosecution of this case? It's not over yet, and there's chess moves still to be made, but, I can't help coming away thinking, wow, is this the best they could have done with what they had? Could they have had more, and did they use the best strategy?
Right now, I would have to give them a D+ or a C-. I don't know, first of all, why this evidence that the judge did not allow in for the third developer. Why was that held?
Yeah.
They got that back in June of 2008. So that was the first miscue.
Mm-hmm. I believe they said something like, "We're just human. We just made a mistake."
Such thing. Here you come the day of trial, asking to produce evidence that you've had over a year. Maybe there was a logical basis for that, but at this point in time, it's unexplained. Yeah. And then to open and see, you never, never promise a jury something that you can't deliver. That's a rule it's in stone for them to introduce all this testimony that they were going to present, not testimony, but the opening arguments that they were going to hear testimony from Lipscomb, and then not to produce him, just is a major, major faux pas right in front of the jury, because the jury, you've told them, you've introduced your case, you've laid your case out, you've laid a roadmap, and then all of a sudden you change course. And at some point in time, we'll get the reason for this.
That's what I was going to ask this question about that, but let me let our listeners ask some questions first at 410-319-8888. And Tamika, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Welcome. You're on the air, Tamika.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I was a little surprised by what happened today myself. I think the prosecution overlooked the obvious. This is someone's boyfriend. Why would your boyfriend buy you 10 or 20 gift cards? Why wouldn't he just buy you just one gift card or... And why were they sent in these anonymous envelopes? I'm a little suspect of that. The other thing is some of the other things that have gone on, within the city. And I think they had an opportunity to present those things. I don't know if they got scared that Mr. Lipscomb's not going to be strong enough, witness because of what his driver said and some transactions that he did. But it was just a little shocking that they would drop the two most important charges when they had an opportunity to say to the jury, hey, don't you think that's a little odd that a boyfriend would give you all these cards instead of just buy you one? Or that type of thing. So that's pretty much my comment. Instead Tamika, of just giving you so the fur coat directly.
Right. Let's grab that one first, Dwight.
Well, they've aborted their case. I mean, the judge had no choice but to dismiss the counts that were predicated upon Lipscomb's involvement. All of that had to go. So for some reason, they made some decision, either because of his credibility or something they discovered in the last hour that made them to abort half of their case and try to salvage the remaining testimony of the first witness.
Melody Fern, were you about to say something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I guess I was just trying to see where Tamika is coming from, and I guess she's talking more just about the original case that the prosecution put on. Is that right, Tamika?
Tamika is gone.
Oh, she gone.
But I think she is talking about that. Yeah.
And I also they threw out, as well as the two charges, the judge threw out at least 38 pieces of evidence in the case that had been presented, and also up to and including all of Circuit City, all of Old Navy gift cards, all of Giant gift cards, and all but $500 of the Target gift cards and $500 of the Best Buy gift cards. So, you know, they really just...
Because all that's tainted by Lipscomb.
They amputated their whole case. Right. And I watched the jury as they filed back in, and then the judge explained to them, you know, the new world order here.
Right.
You know, you are to disregard this. But there was a lot of smirks in the jury box.
Smirks.
And I thought that was very interesting as well.
I want to go back to the phones. I have another question about the Lipscomb and the power of what him not being on the witness stand. But I have to ask you, as a lawyer who's tried many cases and won a lot of big ones, what would that smirk say to you?
Well, they are totally confused. And what the smirk might also say, that what the judge did in terms of throwing out was what they were coming to some type of agreement as jurors, that the state had not presented a case.
410-319-8888. Eugene, you're on the air.
People. Hi, Dwight. Hi, everyone.
Well, good evening.
I wanted to agree with Dwight. As a lawyer myself, this was totally surprising, but I think what happened, something had to happen recently to for them to question their own witnesses' character, either for veracity or honesty or something that came up that they knew under cross-examination he would get destroyed on, which would ruin their case. Unfortunately for them, by not having him testify, it actually should have ruined their case, too. I agree with Dwight. The judge really got caught off guard, but you can't get caught off guard to the point where you lose your ability to enforce the rules of law. I mean, at the point where the witness couldn't testify to any of those accusations that the prosecution was claiming, but it really makes the case null and void in terms of this current jury because it's too tainted. I mean, it's just too perfect. And there's no way that they'll be able to block that out. It's just not going to happen. So I agree with Dwight all the way around.
Well, that leads to my question about that. Before we go back to the phones, and thank you for that call. Before we go to our next call, is James and Edward. You said earlier, Dwight, that you thought that this kind of benefited the prosecution more than the defense. But if I'm a juror, I might have heard all this stuff, but wouldn't I also think, well, they don't put Lipscomb on the stand. He's the whole case, it seems to me, against...
No, it doesn't benefit the prosecution.
I thought so what you said. I misunderstood you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I might have misunderstood.
Okay.
This is definitely benefits to the defense.
Right,
if there's any case left. What I might have said was that if the prosecution wanted to salvage anything, after they had discovered some infirmity with Lipscomb, and they wanted to salvage something, then the best thing would be to abort and kick Lipscomb to the curb and try to salvage what they already had in.
I mean,
but this is definitely, I mean, positive for the defense all the way around.
Dwight, it's something complicated that we're going to learn, or do you think what we see is what we got, and that's the reason? Because, you know, was it just simply that Arnold put on a really good good defense and, opened their eyes to what's going to happen, and they just sort of sat back, calculated the odds over a beer one last night or something and said, we don't have it.
I hate to be conspiratorial, but I tend to think that if something had to happen, you don't spend all these hundreds of thousands of dollars. And go. I mean, I've always argued that they never should have brought the case in the first place. But if you do, then to abort it at this stage, something had to happen.
I mean, I think that from the first day,
when
we had opening statements, and the defense got up, Arnold Weiner got up, and, you know, the first sentence out of his mouth was, we don't dispute that she spent the gift card.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That kneecapped them right there. And I think that's when the playing field changed. And I think that there were questions from reporters to Mr. Rohrbaugh. When is Arnold, when is Mr. Lipscomb coming on the stand? When is he coming on the stand? And he would say, not today, not today. So I think the shuffling started right after that opening statement.
I don't see the shuffling. I didn't see it negative to the prosecution at that point. At that point, it seems to me the prosecution had opened and they forced the defense almost to change strategies from a mix-up with the cards to the fact that the cards were for her.
How did they force them to do this?
Well, it seems whatever their presentation was seems to have forced the defense to come up with a second or backup strategy from what was originally said in pretrial statements. First of all, if you recall, it was about the mix-up of the cards, that she used cards that she got mixed up with Lipscomb's cards.
Mm-hmm.
And then it fell back to the fact that the cards were intended for her, even though you get a second thing in there, even though the Turner cards might have gotten mixed up with the Lipscomb cards.
Right.
It got a little confusing, but I thought they were sort of even draw at the end of closing.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Let me get another caller in here, listening here to ask their questions. 410-319-8888. On our panel today is Dwight Pettit, noted criminal defense attorney here in Baltimore. Fern Chen, founder, editor, and publisher of the Baltimore Brew. Of course, Melody Simmons has been with us here every day and been covering the trial every day for us here at the Center for Emerging Media and WEAA. 410-319-8888 is the number. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. LaVon, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark and all the panel.
Welcome.
I just had a couple of questions. First, I just want to know, do they have any, what are the other five counts? Are they weighty? Do they have a case with that? Should it be dropped? And I kind of agree with one of the panels that said that this should have never been brought to trial in the first place.
That's why I
petted. Well, if this whole thing is thrown out, will they come back later and say, okay, this is now an ethical issue and we're going to bring up on charges on ethics because she didn't report it on, disclosing on her kind of ethics statement? Will that come back again?
I think the main thing you'll have to be concerned about if everything is dropped is whether or not there's a proceeding of the second trial. I think if this happens the way it's happening, there's going to be a lot of public pressure for them not to proceed with the second trial, which is presently scheduled for sometime, I think,
in March,
in March, early spring.
Right, March 1st. I wonder what you guys think of the remaining, Turner aspect of the case. I mean, he wasn't the most blazingly strong witness, but he did tie, the whole concept of these cards were for the needy to, to the cards. That was what he thought. That's what he said. He told her there was no boyfriend relationship there, so that argument can't be made. And he, he even wrote it down on his statement, this is for charity. So, it ain't Ron Lipscomb, but it's somebody.
And that's what they're going to try to argue. I mean, if the state goes forward, hey, look, we presented to you one case, even though we didn't get to you the second case or the third case, but the one case is solid. Mm. But I think when you talked about the smirk, Melanie talked about the smirk on the jury's face, I think that they are so now dissatisfied and suspect of the prosecution that the whole thing nullifies.
Yeah, but there's five charges that remain are pretty solid, but as Dwight said, the whole thing could still crumble pretty easily.
What are the five charges that remain?
They're theft charges. They stem from some of the gift cards given over by Patrick Turner, another developer, and also just talking about the expenditure and what her fiduciary responsibilities are as a public official. When certain gifts are given over, what's her responsibility as a public official? Where's the fine line? So there are five theft charges remaining, and Warren Brown, the defense attorney, was down in the court today and really talked a lot to reporters about the need to have Mayor Dixon on the stand so she could testify as to her state of mind when she was spending those gift cards.
Now, would you do that, Dwight?
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. The whole ball game has changed now. I don't know whether Warren was talking before this development or afterwards.
Oh, he was talking after.
And he was still talking about putting her on the stand. I don't know about that now. At this point in time, there's a valid argument that you rest in. Just argue that there's reasonable doubt and the state did not make a case either – either to what was alluded to, obviously, and you use that as a wedge to go in against the Turner evidence and say some reasonable doubt has been suggested in terms of credibility throughout.
We have to take a very short break. James and Bill, the next two callers up, we're going to come back to your calls as we talk with Dwight Pettit, Fern Shen, Melody Simmons. We may be joined by Doug Colbert as well from the law school to give his perspective on what's going on with Sheila Dixon's trial today. Seems that we may not be covering this after this week. Maybe it'll post next week, but maybe all over but the shouting by Friday. We'll see. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite looks at the growing up in the city with the youth issue, featuring stories on child prodigies, the lives of teenagers, arrested adolescents, and how Baltimore can beat poverty by creating children's zones. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We'll be right back.